Welcome to Shades of Cool. You're listening to WUAG 103.1, and we're streaming across WUAG.net. This is a very special episode. I remember when you were watching shows in the 70s, and next week, a very special episode of Different Strokes. Well, this is a very special Shades of Cool, because we are lucky enough to be graced with the presence of author, historian, great guy all around, Mark A. Moore. And he has written a book, an incredible book, actually, a labor of love, if you will, entitled The Jan and Dean Record, A Chronology of Studio Sessions, Live Performances, and Chart Positions, a book that examines the career of Jan Barry and Dean Torrance in very, 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 very strong detail. And you find out everything you want to know. It's a very, very beautiful book. So thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and what we're going to do tonight is we're going to highlight the art of Jan Barry and his pal Dean Torrance, and we're going to talk about their career, talk about the book, and play some great examples from their work. And we're going to primarily focus on the golden era of 1963 through 1966, but some of the stuff before it and a bit of the stuff after it. Start out talking about the book, which, by the way, is published by McFarland Press. It's about 500 pages, or close to it, close to 450 pages. And you can get it, what's the website you can get the book from?
You can get it
at Amazon.
Amazon.com and at McFarland's website.
Yeah.
I think it's McFarlandBooks.com.
Yes, and if you're interested in anything having to do with 60s pop and rock and the Southern California scene, you know, if you're interested in the Beach Boys and you want to get into Jan and Dean, if you're already a Jan and Dean fan, I mean, it's just absolutely essential. It's a beautiful piece of work. Tell me a bit about how you got into Jan and Dean specifically, and how you kind of became the curator of the legacy of Jan Barry.
I got into it in 1978 when the Dead Man's Curve film came out. I was a 12-year-old kid, and it was the music that really hit me hard about it. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was great, and loved the period. I was already interested in 50s music and so forth, so it was a natural thing. And as I got older, I got interested in the dramatic aspects of the story, mm-hmm. and kept coming back to it. And, you know, there wasn't a whole lot available on them in published format. You had the Paul Morantz Rolling Stone article, which came out in 74. That was really the basis for the mm-hmm. film. And you had Dave Marsh's anthology liners in 71. And
that was
really
a big one for me.
It was. Yeah. That was a landmark thing. It really was. And so from there, you know, it just... you know, it took a while to get into it and to really deciding I wanted to write about it, and, you know, then from there going to get the documentary evidence I needed.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, how did you eventually get to the point where, because at this point, I mean, you basically inherited a lot of Jan Barry's actual, you know, work and documentation in terms of being able to study it.
Right.
I mean, in this book, you know, to anyone who's might want to read it, I mean, it has documentation and all, you know, of what checks Jan wrote, all the AFM contracts for, you know, Jan and Dean sessions. It's incredibly exhaustive. Like, how did you become privy to all of this documentation and just all the incredible stuff that fills this book?
Well, as I started doing interviews, I knew that I majored in history in college, so I knew I wanted documentary evidence to really study the era. And,
of course, you've done other historical projects that don't even relate necessarily to music. So,
and you know, knowing that Jan was the producer and the arranger, I knew mm-hmm. not knowing what he had, I knew that he was the guy I wanted to check with. You know, even given his condition, mm-hmm. What, you know, did he have an archive? And it turned out that he did. Mm-hmm. And so I contacted him and his wife. And really, his wife was the
facilitator,
right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I told them what I wanted to do. They got interested in it, mm-hmm. and that's how it happened.
Yeah, wonderful. I got into it in a similar fashion. That's one of the reasons I'm so excited to do this program. Is I'm a big fan, and I first talked to Mark through a website entitled The Smile Shop. Anyone who's listening who used to be a part of that, Jeff Mason, John Hunt, John Lane, or you know what we're talking about, but I noticed quickly that Mark seemed to be the Jan and Dean guy. He really knew what was going on. So I talked a lot with him over the years, and just so happy to see him, you know, fulfill his dream of, you know, doing like the ultimate Jan and Dean repository in book form. and he's run a website and done various things and supervised, you know, liner notes for reissues, digital reissues. But this book is really just a great culmination of that love. It's something to be really proud of. When I first heard Jan and Dean, again, it was the, like Mark said, it was the Dead Man's Curve film, and Rodney Bingenheimer, a DJ in Los Angeles with ties to Jan and Dean and Kim Fowley and some of those colorful LA characters. He played Ride the Wild Surf, and sometime in the 80s, and in a reverent fashion, was like, Ride the Wild Surf, the greatest rock and roll record of 1964. It was, oh, okay. Then, you know, when Dean's project, or Dean's Jan and Dean project, Save for a Rainy Day, was released on in the late 90s on Sundays. So really, really loved hearing that, and then got into all the twofer CD reissues on One Way, and since then just been really fascinated. But there's so much stuff in this book, which just shows you, you know, the comparatively little amount of information that's out there on Jan Barry in comparison to, you know, the Beatles or Brian Wilson or whatever. So this is definitely a project that was much, much needed. Let's talk a little bit about how Jan Barry grew up, how he got into music, and you know, just the early period, which really was predated Jan and Dean, and it was actually Jan and Arnie.
Yeah, well, Jan grew up in West Los Angeles, went to University High School, and his influences were really black R&B artists of the 1950s. Hollywood Flames, people like that, and they were an L.A. band, so that was his great love. And he had a fake radio station called K-Jan, which is an ingenious scam to get promo copies of records.
And you can actually find some of that stuff. There's excerpts on YouTube and you know, various collectors' releases where you can hear that. And they are absolutely hilarious.
They really are. And, you know, it's amazing. And that was back when, you know, records were breaking out of the Midwest, like in Cleveland, and LA was kind of behind the game, so him getting those promo records and debuting them for his friends, well, I mean, it was just unheard of.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, basically, what Jan did is, you know, he resorted to, you know, certain means of getting records that he wanted without much resources, but then he just figured out the legal way to do it was to invent his own radio station and write all the record companies and tell them, like, he just got every record before it was released.
Right.
So incredible.
And he would have these amazing parties that were sanctioned by his parents, alcohol, everything, you know, and you have the who's who of people up there, Kim Fowley,
yep.
Pat O'Neill, who became the actor Ryan O'Neill, you know, just amazing.
James Brolin when he was Jim Bruderlin.
Absolutely. James and his brother Brian Bruderlin. Absolutely.
Yep. Well, it's just amazing. You just think of him. It really is like the California myth. It really is. I mean, they were living it.
Yeah.
Jan was living it with his parents. And his whole, you know, just coterie of friends. Jan's posse.
Yeah. And he had started playing piano as a kid, but he was real fidgety and wasn't interested in being a serious student. So he learned the basics. He could play piano. Mm-hmm. And he drove his parents crazy with it. And so he started playing out in the garage. They had a piano out there. And so that became, they sort of set it up to be a combination studio. They didn't use the garage for cars. They used it for Jan's combination bedroom studio. And it started with a Ampex tape recorder that his father got, which is really nice that you could get reverb. It's just top of the line thing. And, you know, it just really took off from there.
And it coalesced around a club gang, if you will, that Brian and Dean and a few other people were in. I mean, Jan and Dean were in, called the Barons, which that whole Barons thing, like, seems, that iconography and that name seems to run like all throughout Jan and Dean's. They have an instrumental called Barons West LA, right?
Yeah, and that was a direct reference to it. Yeah, it was a Hi-Y school club. The YMCA sponsored clubs for girls and boys, Hi-Ys and Tri-Ys. And there were a bunch of them at University High School. And they had their own patches and jackets and affiliates. The Barons jackets were gray with white sleeves. And, James Brolin, Arnie Ginsberg, and the two guys of Frank Sinatra Jr. kidnapping fame later, Barry Keenan and Joe Amsler were also members of the Barons.
And the members of the what later became the Matadors vocal group, right? Were they involved in that at all?
They were in the Sirs. Minicello was older than Jan, a couple years older, if not more. Vic Diaz was younger. He was in Ken Barry's class, and they were in the Sirs. So they were, you know, different clubs were involved. I think Dean at one point was in the Galatians, but then Jan got him into the Barons. So, yeah, and the singing group that Jan formed was an offshoot of that. Some mm-hmm. of the guys in the school club were in the singing group, and some weren't. But he mm-hmm. called the singing group the Barons. So, it's, you know.
Yeah. So how did this coalition eventually become what became the first released by Jan and Arnie?
Arnie Ginsberg got the idea for a song named Jenny Lee. And Arnie had been around in the mm-hmm. in the K-Jan parties and the tapes mm-hmm. that they were making. And Dean had been around. And he got the idea for a song. Arnie drove a laundry truck, and he had a route, and he mm-hmm. got the melody. And, you know, he would write it down. He would stop, write down a few ideas, mm-hmm. continue the route. Then he took what he had to Jan, and they finished it together. Mm-hmm. And they're still in high school. I think Arnie's 17 at the time. Jan's 16, almost 17, within a month or so of turning 17, maybe 2 months. And they started singing this song, and they wanted to do, you know, it was a hit at their parties, mm-hmm. and they wanted to get it transferred from tape to acetate so they could say they had their own record. And they took it downtown. Well, not downtown, but they took it down. Joe Lubin said it was United over mm-hmm. there, Sunset and Gower. And they got it transferred, and Joe Lubin heard it. And Joe Lubin was A&R executive for Arwen Records, mm-hmm. Marty Melcher's yep. label. And Joe was an Englishman, really entrepreneurial guy, had a lot of drive. And he went to bat for that record, and he convinced Marty Melcher to buy it. And so when they did...
Marty Melcher, of course, being the father of Terry Melcher and the husband of Doris Day.
Correct. And when they did buy it, that was Jan's first introduction into the Hollywood studio system, mm-hmm. because Joe hired all the best black mm-hmm. R&B musicians, Plaz Johnson, his brother Ray, mm-hmm. Earl Palmer, Ernie Freeman. Mm-hmm. You know, Ernie Freeman kind of arranged the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And what they did was they took Jan and Arnie's garage track, mm-hmm. which was really only Jan and Arnie, the only two guys mm-hmm. on it. Jan playing piano and singing at the same time, and Arnie on improvised percussion mm-hmm. and singing lead. And so they took that. They did a bunch of takes of that with Joe. And they took the best take, and Joe took it to Ernie Freeman. It was overseen by Don Rahlke. Mm-hmm. But really, Ernie was the guy, according to Joe. And he synced up that mm-hmm. that garage vocal yep. and percussion track with the famous studio musicians. And then they got some studio singers, some pro studio singers, to do the backgrounds. And mm-hmm. For distribution, Joe got Dot Records to do a one-off deal for mm-hmm. distribution of Jenny Lee. Mm-hmm. He called all the black stations he could think of, because Joe was into that R&B anyway. And that's how that record broke. It broke first in Los Angeles, of course. Jan broke into Joe's office, stole the acetate, took it to a station, and got it played locally. And then Joe went to Randy Wood and Dot, and then it just took off from there.
All right, well, let's hear it. We're going to play that. We're going to play two songs to represent the early, the pre-Surf City era. We're going to play Dot Record by Jan and Arnie, Jenny Lee, the one that started it off, and then one it was the first released by Jan and Dean, entitled Baby Talk, which we'll talk about after. So here's those two tracks. This is Jenny Lee. This is where it all started. Shades of Cool, during our Jan and Dean special with esteemed author Mark A. Moore, who wrote a book entitled The Jan and Dean Record, and it's really incredible history, day-by-day history of Jan and Dean's career, and focusing particularly on the artistry of Jan Barry. We just heard two songs. We talked about Jenny Lee, which is by Jan and Arnie. Then we followed it with the first hit by Jan and Dean, which is entitled Baby Talk, a classic late doo-wop single. How did Arnie split the scene and Dean show up?
Well, what was the transition there? Yeah, the transition was that Arnie had been in ROTC in high school, and he had a military commitment, and he had a military commitment from day one, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And when
so he had an expiration date.
Yeah. So yeah. When Jan and Arnie hit, when Jenny Lee came out, it was in the public press. You know, it was mm-hmm. spilled. The Santa Monica Press, I think, was the first one. I mean, the Santa Monica Evening Outlook put it out there that Arnie had a forthcoming military commitment, and that was one issue. And the other issue was that by the end of 1958 and the end of Jan and Arnie's three singles on Arwen Records, Arnie had become thoroughly disillusioned with the music industry. Mm-hmm. He didn't like the seedier aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
When he got up to Oakland and saw Lou Adler and the black artists and the drugs and so forth, mm-hmm. it just wasn't his scene. And he mm-hmm. felt he wasn't talented enough. Mm-hmm. He looked at the people who really had the stuff
mm-hmm.
and could see that they were talented and were where they needed to be, and he didn't feel like he measured up. So those are some of the underlying things as far as Arnie felt, but there, despite all that, there was the military commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And so, with that being the case, he joined the Navy or enlisted or, you know, went on active mm-hmm. duty with yeah. the Navy in early 59. And Dean, throughout the whole Jan and Arnie gig, Dean had been in the Army Reserve. Mm-hmm. He went in March of 58 and came home in September.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time Arnie is ready to move on, and Arnie did do one project for Joe Lubin, the girl in Zanzibar, which he was totally dismissive of. He didn't like it. But it was just kind of to help ease his segue out of the whole situation. So once that happened, you know, Dean was a natural choice for Jan because Dean had been around since the beginning. He'd been singing with the Barons at Jan's garage. And so they hooked up in early 59.
Of course, he's that kind of like, at the time, you know, young, blonde, flat-top haircut, you know.
Right.
He was a good, you know, a good choice to, then all of a sudden Jan Dean became like, that's like the archetype of like the young, handsome, like California guy.
Yeah, they were the California answer to the Italian guys in New York.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it was a really striking thing, especially when they started getting on television. That's one of the things that...
Because we've got to remind you all, this is way before the Beach Boys.
That's what, one of the things that Lou Adler wanted to start marketing on was their look is very distinctive. And the way they got in touch with Lou Adler was Kim Fowley had kind of turned Lou on to the fact that Jan and Dean were a new act and we're looking for management and for producers. And Kim had been a classmate at University High School, had also done some time in the military, knew Dean at Fort Ord and so forth. And so Jan wanted to meet Lou Adler, and they set that up. And Lou Adler was partners with Herb Alpert at the time. They were coming out of their gig with Keen Records as in, you know, being staff A&R type guys. And so with Jan and Dean, they went off on their own as independent producers, which was kind of a new thing at the time. And Herb Alpert procured Baby Talk for them, which was an East Coast doo-wop tune originally done. It was written in 58, originally done by the Laurels on the East Coast, New York guys. And so when Herb got that, they worked on Baby Talk in Jan's garage, and they used that same system where they had the garage tape that many times spliced over by Jan to get the take with Jan and Dean singing, and then they took that to the studio, and they meshed it with the musicians.
And so essentially the Jan and Dean and Jan and Artie material that predates their signing with Liberty, most of it was recorded, you know, it's actual garage rock. It was recorded.
And that would continue even through all their Dory stuff. It would be recorded like that.
Yep. So Baby Talk obviously was a top 10 single?
It barely cracked top 10. I think it was number 10.
Yeah. So they made some more records for Dory, some really good. I'd love to play a lot more of their doo-wop stuff because I really love it, but trying to get to the, you know, the golden age. They recorded an album for Dory. What was it, the Jan and Dean Sound, or was it just called Jan and Dean?
Jan and Dean Sound.
Yeah, Jan and Dean Sound. And then moved to the Challenge label, I believe. Was that Challenge their next label?
Yes.
Yeah, where they had their next big hit was a redo of the famous standard Heart and Soul. Very good version of that. And then how did they get to Liberty in 1962?
They got to Liberty in late 61. And the way that happened was the contract with Dory ran out, and Lou Adler had feelers out. And he got hired by Nevins Kirshner, which is a corporate entity in New York City, you know, around the Brill Building, those writers.
And of course, Don Kirshner was, you know, had the whole stable of writers with the Brill Building in various places, and later had Don Kirshner's rock concert on TV in the 70s. And
yeah, so it was Don Kirshner and Al Nevins, and they had a really good thing going there, and they hired Lou based on his success with Jan and Dean. So Jan and Dean were his calling card when he went looking for other things. And so once Lou signed with Nevins Kirshner, that opened the door for Jan and Dean to sign with Nevins Kirshner's artists. So they did that. And then once they were signed with Nevins Kirshner, that company brokered the deal with Liberty, and Snuff Garrett helped with that because he was friends with Lou Adler.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay, let's see. Getting into how did Jan and Dean first cross paths with the Beach Boys? We should mention, like, just real quick, that their first, when they went to Liberty, they had their big hit when they first went to Liberty was a record called Linda, which is another old standard that actually, oddly enough, was written about the young Linda McCartney when she was Linda Eastman, and did a version of that, which became a top 20 hit. And then after that, what we're getting into is the history of the song Surf City, which was co-written by Brian and Jan Barry. So I just wanted to get you up to speed on that before we start talking about how Jan and Brian got to know each other.
Yes, so with Jan and Dean's success, and, you know, Linda being a hit. They started, by August of 62, they started playing live together, the two bands, because the Beach Boys had started to hit. They had the Surfing single, a song called Surfin', which was, you know, modest number 75 hit. Then they had Surfin' Safari, which is a much bigger hit.
So at this point, when these guys start playing together, Jan and Dean are just the unquestioned stars of the scene. They've been around for years.
Right.
But basically 4 years at that time, and the Beach Boys have, you know, two local hits and one national hit.
You know? Right, and they were playing, and you know, all around L.A., and it was only natural that they would play together. And Jan and Dean would be the headliners in those early days, and they would play, and the Beach Boys would back them, and then the Beach Boys would, Jan and Dean would sing their two hits with them, and it would be, they'd just all stand together on stage. It wasn't one in back and one in front. Yeah. It just kind of...
Which the Beach Boys were amazed that point that Jan and Dean would stand, you know, on the stage with them being so much bigger stars. But how did, what's the origins of Surf City?
Well, as a progression of that, Jan and Brian became friends. The Beach Boys and Jan and Dean became friends. And Lou Adler was the one who kind of pushed the idea of Jan and Brian working as songwriters together. So he made that happen. And Jan and Brian met in a songwriting capacity officially in Lou Adler's office. And that was the West Coast office of Nevins Kirshner at the time. And that was at 6515 Sunset Boulevard. And so when that happened, that's when Brian, Jan and Dean liked Surfin' USA, which had already been recorded. I think the first recording, the backing track was in January, I think, 63. So that was already in the works, but Brian played it as an example. Jan liked it. And Brian had the unfinished Surf City. That song originated with him, as did a song called Gonna Hustle You. And those ended up being the first two songs that he worked on, that Brian worked on with Jan. They were unfinished. He wasn't going to do anything with them. And so he finished them with Jan. They sat down at a piano to get the basic melody and work on the lyrics. And they got the basic thing done. And then in March of 63, March 20th, Jan took it in the studio. He wrote an arrangement for it and took it into the studio with the Wrecking Crew.
Yes, and this song, of course, once it hit their airwaves, exploded, became a number one hit. Not only Jan and Dean's first number one hit, but it became the first song with any type of Brian Wilson involvement to go to number one, which ended up sending shockwaves throughout the Beach Boys organization, particularly with Brian's crazy, overbearing
dad, Murray,
and Mike Love as well, that considered Jan and Dean song pirates, and
right.
Which became a source of hilarity for Jan and Brian. But here it is. This is one of the songs, one of the biggest bricks in the California myth. This is Surf City. We're going to follow up with the follow-up single, which is Honolulu Lulu, which we'll talk about after that. But here's Surf City.
Yeah. knees now. Their crazy grass shift really sways in the breeze now. Riding down a heavy, you're lying in the sand. She's a hypnosurfer girl in the land. She's mine. Hallelujah, she's mine. Every year at Minnetonka, and all the surfers know her from Rincon to Baja. When the beach is quiet and you know we're out of luck, we pray for sir, I'll make it out in our truck. Just me and Honolulu, me and Honolulu, queen of the surfer girl. She got a little bold wind. She tried a little spinner, but her wax wouldn't hold. Woo! Over the falls, instead of hanging ten. But then she paddled out and tried again. But she's my Honolulu. She's my Honolulu. Queen of the surfer girl.
On Shades of Cool on our Jan and Dean special with our guest author Mark A. Moore talking about his book The Jan and Dean Record, and we just played two great classics singles by Jan and Dean from 1963, Surf City and Honolulu Lulu. And you know, everyone knows Surf City, but Honolulu Lulu in terms of the production, the arrangement, the pictorial quality of the music, it's a huge leap. You know, no one seems to know Honolulu Lulu now, but now it's hard to not hear it as the superior record.
Yeah, it was. And it was, you know, it was a pretty big hit. Number 11, mm-hmm. Billboard, number 10, Cashbox. But, yeah, it shows Jan's progression as a record producer. It's better produced than Surf City. Mm-hmm. And the vocal mix, the vocal blend is a lot better than Surf City. Mm-hmm. And there you have the Matadors on the backing vocals. Mm-hmm. Tony Minicello, Manuel Sanchez, and Vic Diaz. And, of course, Dean's on there. And, you know, that was really where they started getting the vocal sound clicking a little mm-hmm. better. And just, you know, better record mm-hmm. altogether.
Tell me a bit about how Jan put his productions together, his arrangements, and then his particular usage of the Wrecking Crew, which is different to that of Phil Spector or Brian Wilson.
Well, Jan mapped out everything ahead of time. You know, he had taken, aside from his music lessons as a kid, mm-hmm. We have to remember that Jan and Dean are college students, and Jan had taken music theory classes mm-hmm. just to better his knowledge, and he also studied on his own with a book called The Professional Arranger Composer by Russell Garcia. So Jan wrote all his arrangements out. He wrote all the notes out, all the parts for each instrument. You know, if it's brass or woodwinds, mm-hmm. it's specific note for note. The bass lines are mm-hmm. note for note. The guitars and the piano are chord mm-hmm. charts. Sometimes certain guitar licks are mm-hmm. written out note for note, but usually just the chords. And, you know, of course, with your studio musicians, your Wrecking Crew people, mm-hmm. they're coming up. Their creativity is going into mm-hmm. it. They're going back and forth with Jan. And they finally got this signature sound where, you know, you've got the eighth note and 16th note grooves going on mm-hmm. underneath the vocals. And Jan would write these little instructions on the score, Jan and Dean shtick, and they would know what he meant because they worked so many times yeah. together. And so that's how that signature sound came together. But so, yeah, so Jan wrote all his stuff out, and you know, these musicians read music mm-hmm. Or, you know, chord charts. And that's how it happened.
And And that compared to Phil Spector, who relied upon as a genius arranger, Jack Nitzsche,
right.
And Brian, who, although he technically did the arrangements, would come in kind of on the fly, hum parts. You know, it was a lot more exploratory, Brian's process, whereas Jan was really very much hands-on in terms of controlling every aspect, from the composition to the arrangement, the scores, all the way through the dub down.
And one of his experiments early on, and it started with the Surf City Sessions, mm-hmm. It was the dual drums, the two drummers.
Yes.
Engineer Bones Howe told me that he originally had the idea to record the drum track and then have Howe or Earl play with the recording of the drum mm-hmm. track, and immediately that was too difficult. And he said, well, let's just play it live. Mm-hmm. And you had two drummers that could pull that off in tandem.
Which were generally the great Hal Blaine and Earl Palmer, right?
Yes, it was them, and they would write the parts out. You know, the drum fills are written on the charts, but mm-hmm. if they changed them in the studio, they would just mark the charts.
Mm-hmm.
And Hal and Earl would decide, you know, if they're, mm-hmm. you know, what's the floor tom going to mm-hmm. be, what's the others.
And, of course, they're also working with other, you know, great famous names, such as Leon Russell, Glenn Campbell, Don Randy, Carol Kay, Joe Osborne, you know, all those greats that you hear about whenever you hear about the Wrecking Crew. They work with all those people.
Yeah, Tommy Tedesco, Billy yes. Strange.
And Jan was the guy who got Brian Wilson into that.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, he was the guy who, Brian is on record as saying that he was able to get much, much cleaner tracks with working with the Wrecking Crew, and the Jan, he credited Jan for that.
Yeah, he spent a lot more time working or watching Jan than he would have with Spector, because he wasn't really a member mm-hmm. of Spector's inner circle.
Yeah.
He was influenced by Spector a great
mm-hmm.
deal, but
yeah.
he just wasn't as close personally to
yeah.
Spector than he was to Jan. So he witnessed Jan a lot in the studio, and Jan helped him with the technical aspects of it. And really, another thing Brian got from Jan is just how to work the system,
mm-hmm.
you know, how
yeah.
to work the whole thing, you know, get the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know.
Yep. Okay. I wanted to talk about, as we got to the fall and the winter of 1963, primarily Jan and Dean were, you know, singles artists, as pretty much all pop and rock artists were up to that point. But he created an album entitled Drag City, which came out around the same time as the Beach Boys did a devoted concept album devoted to Cars entitled Little Deuce Coupe. Really good album, but Drag City, I think, even surpasses it in terms of the tracks, the complexity, the sophistication, even the songwriting to a large degree. I find it superior on Drag City, and this is really an album that has kind of gotten lost, but I feel more people should listen to it and check it out. And, of course, it has a classic opener, which was their next single, Drag City.
Yeah, that's a really solid album. It was their highest charting album,
mm-hmm.
and it was really the first really solid concept album that was written mostly by Jan and his core creative team, which included Brian, Roger Christian, and Artie Kornfeld's on there, and Barry Mann has a songwriting credit on there, but really the core nucleus of what became the writers for Jan and Dean, not Don Altfeld yet, but getting there. That's really solid, and those, you know, that Drag City album really has some of their best album cuts, that and the next album, and they're really solid productions, and it's really masculine sounding, fat, frothy tracks. That's what engineer Bones Howe called them, fat and frothy.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So we're gonna play Drag City, and then we're gonna play there was a song that shows up as an album track on the Drag City album that was reworked. Partially re-recorded and became their first huge single of 1964. So we're going to hear that right after that. It's entitled Dead Man's Curve, one of the great rock singles of all time. And then we'll talk more about that track afterward. So let's hear Drag City.
Chicken, make it out. remember, Doc, I started to swerve. And then I saw the Jag slide into the curve. I know I'll never forget that horrible sight. I guess I found out for myself that everyone was right.
Welcome back from Dead Man's Curve.
Welcome back to Shades of Cool. We're doing our Jan and Dean special with author Mark A. Moore, who has graciously consented to be on the show tonight so we could talk to him about the book and about the career of Jan and Dean. I'm your host, your usual host, Ian, and Becky's in here somewhere.
Hi.
She's in here. We'll be featured more next week when we do our special on the Kinks. But yeah, we're doing Jan and Dean this week, and it's a real pleasure. It's going by too quickly. We just played two more classics. We played Drag City, which was a great single from the late 1963 and the title track of a great album, which you should seek out and listen to. And then Dead Man's Curve, which was the title track. It was originally an album track on Drag City, then reworked for single release, and then served as the, co-title track of the next album, the first album of 1964, Dead Man's Curve, The New Girl in School. What can you tell us about Dead Man's Curve? Which is, I think, just one of the definitive rock singles.
Yeah, it really is. And it's, it's really a death disc. And, you know, people have talked about the satire, which is very important for Jan and Dean, but there's nothing funny about that record. The implication is that the driver of the Jag was killed. Okay, so what's funny is when they immediately start making fun of the song and live performances and in their liner notes and so forth. So that's the genius thing about the satire of Dead Man's Curve. But that's a monster hit record for Jan and Dean. Artie Kornfeld thought that record should have been number one. He always thought that the New Girl siphoned off some of the some of the chart positions for it. I don't know if that's true, but that record is seen as their most important records. You know, the most important record from today's vantage point.
Yeah.
And it was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 2008.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very, very deservedly. It's a real masterpiece. And I remember, because it drives me crazy some of the times when people try to justify, like, their love of the Beach Boys by saying, well, Paul McCartney loves Pet Sounds. You know, not to get into that kind of justification, but a lot of heavy musicians and songwriters and producers really, really had a lot of respect for, in particular, Jan Barry's production and the songwriting. I've listened myself to several different radio interviews with Frank Zappa where he specifically mentions Jan and Dean. You talk about that in your book. You quote him extensively on hailing, you know, things like Dead Man's Curve, and what's the other one that he talks about?
Little Old Lady.
Yeah, and Summer Means Fun, even, he picked up on.
Yeah, he liked the chord progression on that song,
Yeah, so great. Of course, you know, Keith Moon absolutely idolized. I mean, everyone thinks, oh, yeah, Keith Moon, the greatest Beach Boys. No, he liked Jan and Dean even more.
Right.
That was his ultimate thing, and everyone who was around, you know, Keith Moon's house will always talk about him blasting Jan and Dean records at all hours of the night.
Exactly.
And, you know, and there's a lot of other people as well.
Yeah, Zappa and Jan had a lot in common in terms of the arranging and musicians, hiring musicians and tinkering in the studio, a lot of the same things.
And the whole just idea of the humor being an essential component.
And nonconformity and that whole thing.
Yep, and the idea of satirizing that which you love, where it works as a parody and, you know, an ironic send-up, but also really, really nice examples of the very thing that they're, you know, supposedly parroting as well. Just, he did that with, Jan did that with the doo-wop genre. Of course, you know, Zappa did that, you know, pretty much his whole career. And, you know, with the surf genre, then, you know, the folk rock thing, and then pop art, and just pretty much the whole way Jan was doing that, as well as being just an incredible artist and in his own right, an arranger and songwriter. Dead Man's Curve, that's a good segue into, we wanted to talk a little bit about Jan's outside work, outside productions, which he didn't do, you know, too much of, but he did do some interesting things. And you've brought a couple tracks. In particular, this first one we're going to play is one that actually isn't commercially available.
Yeah. This,
tell us about it.
Yeah, this is an important archival track for Jan because it's from 1961. He arranged and produced it in 1961. He co-wrote it with Don Altfeld, which was one of his main writing collaborators.
Altfeld.
Yeah, right.
Sorry, a little joke from Jan and Amy Batman.
Right. And so, yeah, and there was going to be... they were going to market it. It's in the girl group genre, and they were going to market it by an artist named Pixie. And it was never released, but it's almost certainly Blossoms related. You know, it's got that sound to it, and it. But the reason this is an important archival release, it's completely finished, never released, but it has all the hallmarks, arrangement and production wise, that you're going to hear later on Jan Barry's productions, like in Honolulu. There's a rhythmic lick in this song that's in Honolulu. The eighth note transitions between verse and chorus that are on so many things are all in this record. It's fantastic. And it also, the intro also it influenced the intro to Dead Man's Curve.
And then tell us a little bit about the Angels track, which is going to follow it, which it's funny. I mean, everyone these days knows about Brian Wilson's outside work with the Honeys, which was his fiance's vocal group, Marilyn, and who also sang on some Jan and Dean records like The New Girl in School. But Jan was the one who actually had success.
Yeah, with the Angels song, he had success. He and Artie Kornfeld wrote that song, and right after Jan signed with Nevins Kirshner, not long after that, they were absorbed by Screen Gems in April of 63. And Artie was a Screen Gems writer in New York, Brill Building. And so Don Kirshner put the two together, Artie and Brian, and they ended up over there at the hotel in Brooklyn, and they wrote I Adore Him for the Angels.
You know, and this was their follow-up to kind of a famous record called My Boyfriend's Back.
Yes, number one.
And this followed it up, and it's also a really great record. I think I first heard it on a really great Polygram double CD entitled Growing Up Too Fast. Great two-CD collection of girl group rarities. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, and it did well on the R&B charts. I think it was number 13 R&B and then number, I think, 25 pop.
Great, and we're going to end the set with a great track, which is actually a duet between Jan and his then-girlfriend and also artistic collaborator Jill Gibson, which we'll talk more about that and Jill after the set. But we're going to start out with, again, this is an unreleased currently track, so thank you, Mark, for bringing this. This is by Pixie, I'm Dying to Give You My Love.
You're all in love.
103.1 FM. Welcome back to Shades of Cool. Getting into the second half of our Jan and Dean Spectacular with our guest, Mark A. Moore, who put together an incredible book entitled The Jan and Dean Record, A Chronology of Studio Sessions, Live Performances and Chart Positions. But it's a lot more than that. It's not just your dry collection of facts. There's lots of great biographical information on Jan and Dean's career and Jan Barry's history. And it's really great. It's put out by McFarland Press, and you can find it on Amazon and your usual channels. And McFarland has their own website as well. We just did a set devoted to Jan's, some of Jan's outside productions. We played an unreleased track by Pixie, I'm Dying to Give You My Love, The Angels, I Adore Him, and then we finished out with a track that's actually a duet between Jan and Jill Gibson entitled It's As Easy As 1, 2, 3. Tell us a little bit about Jan's relationship with Jill and her history.
Well, Jan and Jill were a couple, and they started dating in 1959. He had entered UCLA in February 59. She was still in high school. And they started dating, and they would have a long relationship up mm-hmm. until late 65, I would say. Mm-hmm. And they were each the love of each other's life for that period. Mm-hmm. And Jill was also a musician, singer, very talented in her own right. And, you know, it was only natural that Jan would collaborate with her. Mm-hmm. She would write if he needed some melody for a song mm-hmm. or some lyrics. She would contribute, and they collaborated, and you know, it was Jill sort of had her own style and her own likes. Mm-hmm. She wasn't necessarily into Jan and Dean's music as much as she was into jazz and stuff like mm-hmm. that.
Yes.
But she could certainly write in the genre. And if he needed some melody snippets mm-hmm. for any song, whether she got credit for it or not, he would mm-hmm. use them. She had a knack for melody, and she could write lyrics too, but I think melody was her strong mm-hmm. suit. And
that's definitely showcased on that track, which Jan actually produced as a duet between the two of them. And he actually recorded another version of that, which is just her as well, right?
Yeah, it's the same backing track, but it's her singing solo, and the lyrics are slightly different. And he arranged and produced that for her on the Imperial label. She had mm-hmm. a solo single with it.
And even after they broke up and Jan had his accident, they remained friends, and she helped him in his post-accident career as well, which is amazing.
Yeah, she
shares amount of loyalty.
She was a good friend to him during that period, and she co-wrote some songs with him for what ended up being on Carnival of Sound.
Yes, and then of course Jill ended up getting a raw deal and being a member of the Mamas and the Papas for about 2 months and whatever. And
right,
unfortunately, had some bad things happen to her, but she survived, and she's still around and very cool.
She's an incredibly talented painter and sculptor. Just amazing.
Yes. Another rare track that you brought to us, which is really incredible. I've auditioned to it. I've listened to it a few times since you sent it to me. It's a version of The Little Old Lady from Pasadena, which is, you know, among Jan and Dean's most famous tracks. But it's just the vocals and the orchestration, right? The horns.
Yeah, it's the brass and woodwinds, mm-hmm. A cappella vocals, and the harmonica solo. And this is from session tape that Jan Barry had absconded with in the 60s. He has had possession of it since the 60s, but in his personal collection at the time he died.
Wow. And on this, we can talk about the backing vocalists. Originally, you worked with, when he started augmenting with studio vocalists, he worked with the Matadors, and then eventually with the great P.F. Sloan, great songwriter and singer in his own right, and Steve Barry, who had their own surf vocal group at the time entitled the Fantastic Baggies, and then later at Dunhill Records became the original Grassroots and various other things, right?
Yeah, they came into the fold through Lou Adler. Mm-hmm. Lou Adler signed them as writers to the West Coast mm-hmm. office of Screen Gems, and they could write anything. And mm-hmm. they wrote specifically for Jan and Dean. They sang on Jan and mm-hmm. Dean's records. There's one track they wrote for Jan and Dean called Debbie Be True that Jan and mm-hmm. Dean didn't mm-hmm. record, but it was on the Baggies album. And just two of the greats, Sloan and Barry. I mean,
yeah,
they did so many cool things.
Yeah, Honey, You, Baby for the Turtles. There'd be so many great.
Right.
Eve of Destruction, of course. Shannon Dean later recorded themselves. But, yeah, so you're going to hear their voices as well on this. And yeah, I'm sure you're familiar. If you're listening to this far, you know the hit version of Little Old Lady from Pasadena. But just listen to this, the detail of this arrangement. And just listen to the musicality of it without even, you know, all the instrumentation, the basic instrumentation. And just have your mind blown by the artistry of Jan Barry.
It's a little old lady from Pasadena. Go, Granny, go, Granny, go, Granny, go. Go, Granny, go, Granny, go, Granny, go. Brand new shiny red super stock Dodge. Everybody say that there's nobody needed around the little old lady. Cause she drives real fast and she drives real hard. Wah, wah, wah. It's the little old lady from Pasadena.
Wave and ride it in alone. Ride, ride, ride. Association. They tool around town in their big grand trees, sitting in their buckets, he's shooting the breeze. You know that all week long they put up jam and preserves, but on the weekend they negotiate. The meeting breaks up with a thunderous roar. Then there's a mad rush to the big old door. They run to the cars at the start of the month. And there's a spin and donuts in the room.
Having a blast doing our Jan and Dean special with author Mark A. Moore and talking about his book, The Jan and Dean Record. Just played a whole block, four great Jan and Dean tracks in a row with pretty outstanding arrangements and scores and just great records all the way around. We heard The Little Old Lady from Pasadena, a studio track of it, which was just vocals, brass, and woodwinds. An unreleased track that Mark was kind enough to bring and share with us. the finished product for Ride the Wild Surf, my favorite Jan Dean record, which was the theme for a film that Jan Dean was supposed to star in, co-star in, but didn't happen due to some pretty strange circumstances. And then an absolutely incredible track entitled The Anaheim Azusa and Cucamonga Sewing Circle Book Review and Timing Association. Just incredible. Then we finished out with Here They Come from All Over the World, which was the theme for a film that Jan Dean actually, I guess it's the most, I guess the actual film that came out, because they did so many things. They did, they tried to do pilots, they tried to star in films, and they were all ill-fated except for, in some fashion, except for The Tammy Show, which was, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest rock and roll film of all time. I mean, I love Hard Day's Night and Don't Look Back and all the ones everyone loves, but The Tammy Show, which is a concert film filmed at the Santa Monica Civic in 1964 with the Rolling Stones and James Brown and Leslie Gore and The Miracles and Marvin Gaye and everybody else. Jan and Dean are the hosts of that. And they introduce all the acts, and they also do a couple songs on their own. And I remember seeing that when I was about 16 or so and just being really blown away. I think that's the first time I actually really saw them, you know, perform and interact and their humor. And that one, I think that's like the epitome of their, like, Jan and Dean as the early versions of Beavis and Butthead.
Right. Yeah.
They've just got those kind of like square heads at that point, and they're just always kind of laughing at their own private jokes, you know, their in jokes. But I think that's a great element of Jan Dean's career. And also that song, which was written by P.F. Sloan and Steve Barry, is used in the great opening credits and show Jan Dean just skateboarding all over every cool place in Hollywood, you know, while, like, the dancers, like, which include Terry Garr, rehearsing, and, you know, the Miracles are jump out of the back of a car, and the Supremes are doing their makeup. You know, it's just,
right.
It's so iconic.
It is.
In every way. But let's talk a little bit about Jan Dean's visual projects, as ill-fated as they were. They started out, the first thing he did in 1963, I believe, was a pilot. So it really was like a surf documentary, but featuring Jan and Dean titled Surf Scene.
Yeah, they got that through producer Lou Irwin. He wanted to do a surf thing and, you know, wanted to get sponsors for it. And he did get money for it. And it's an amazing adventure in itself, just getting that thing shot. But the, you know, making a long story short, the kidnapping of Frank Sinatra Jr. And you know, Dean being, you know, peripherally involved, it just really sent things off the rail. And that was really kind of the first casualty of that. The negative press from that was, you know, even though Dean was not charged with any crime or anything, it just made these explosive headlines. He had to testify in court.
Yeah, basically, with the quick story, just for people around who haven't, because I know there's a couple people listening who aren't necessarily familiar with that story, is that a couple, you know, real good friends of Dean from high school were falling on hard times and kind of strange personalities and decided to hatch this plot to kidnap Frank Sinatra Jr. and told Dean, like, oh, yes, we're going to do this. And he just didn't take it seriously. Like, they, you know, because someone would tell you that and be like, yeah, sure. So they just ask him for money and be like, okay, here's some money for food. But really, they were secreting away the money to, you know, for this plot. And they did kidnap Frank Sinatra Jr. and ended up being this huge thing that was blown wide open for a long time. It was thought, for at least the initial stages of the trial, that it was, that it was a hoax, a publicity hoax hatched by Frank Sinatra Jr. To revive his kind of sagging career. But Dean was actually the one who blew it open in the trial and just admitted the whole thing, that,
right,
like, that he knew about, that it was all real. So it's unfair in a way that Dean, even though he should have known better, to, you know, to suffer, you know, like Jan Dean's career to suffer, when he was in effect the one that, you know, made sure the perpetrators were prosecuted.
Yeah, I mean, it was unfortunate, and, you know, he got on the stand, and, you know, he was loose and joking, but then he finally admitted, like, you know, I didn't realize how bad this was till I had to get down here and testify. Mm-hmm. And so it killed the surf scene. You know, Lou Irwin, the producer, and he said that they went around trying to sell it, and it just wasn't happening because of the headlines.
Mm-hmm. Then they were supposed to co-star with Fabian in a the film Ride the Wild Surf, which is a big, you know, Columbia version of kind of the AIP beach party movies, with also Barbara Eden is in it and Shelley Fabre, who was married to Lou Adler at that time. Jan Dean were supposed to be the co-stars, and they lost out on it because of the fallout from the Frank Jr. kidnapping, which is a shame, but at least they did get that classic title theme in the film. And then 1965, they did a pilot for a show entitled On the Run. Is On the Run before or after? That's after Easy Come, Easy Go, right?
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about Easy Come, Easy Go, their film then. Their film was supposed to be starring them for Paramount Pictures in that same era that Paramount was doing a lot of stuff with Elvis. So Paramount were doing, you know, rock films at that time on some level. They got Jane and Dean. What happened with that?
Well, that came about through Dunhill. At that time, Jane and Dean, they weren't on Dunhill Records, but they were managed out of the Dunhill offices because that's where Lou Adler, Bobby Roberts, and Pierre Cassette were. You know, they had their whole Dunhill Productions, and then they had Dunhill Records. So Jan and Dean were kind of on the Dunhill Productions side. And as Lou Adler was doing more things, when it came to the Dunhill era, Bobby Roberts became Jan and Dean's go-to manager. And so Bobby and Pierre Cassette made a push to get their Dunhill, look for film projects for their Dunhill artists. And so they got Jan and Dean a deal. It was a Dunhill production for Paramount, and Bobby Roberts would have been the producer. And had a really wild, it would have been a wild, over-the-top action comedy. The screenwriter was Maurice Richland, who had done The Pink Panther and Operation Petticoat. Really genius writer, screenwriter.
Very much a slapstick comedy.
Oh, very,
you know,
very much. Lots of sight gags, and you know,
following on from their interest, you know, and things like Laurel and Hardy, and you know, silent comedy.
Yeah. So the original script concept is summarized in the book, and it's literally it's wild. And you know, Dean rightly pointed out that they would have changed some things and ad libbed with the famous, you know, cameos from the comedians like Mel Brooks and so forth.
Yeah.
But amazing project. But there was a train accident on the first or second day of shooting, and a lot of people got hurt. The director, Barry Shear, had internal injuries. Jan had he jumped off the flatbed right when the locomotive crashed into it, and had a severe compound fracture of his left leg.
Yeah, basically just completely shattered his leg.
Yeah, and it made just all kinds of problems. They canceled the film. It eventually got him behind in medical school because he couldn't keep up, and he had to withdraw temporarily. Just a mess.
And then Dean's leg was in a cast for a long, long time because his leg was basically decimated. So they kept doing projects. There's a few albums that show Dean with a cast and on his crutches. And during that period, they got a chance to do another visual project, which was another TV pilot entitled On the Run, which was actually finished. Unfortunately, wasn't able to. Dean had his major accident before he was able to be picked up or anything, but that's on YouTube as well. Let's hear a little bit about that. That I thought was absolutely fascinating because it has, not only is it really funny and it really has, you know, a lot of the same aims and goals as the Monkees TV series, but it also has some really, really incredible concert footage of them in San Diego with the Wrecking Crew backing them.
Right. And that was also procured for them through Dunhill. ABC developed it, and Ashmont Productions, which was William Asher, a very, very good director, very well known for various projects.
The Beach Party films. And
yeah, and 20th Century Fox. That was, that was all greenlit. The screenwriter was Ruth Brooks Flippin, who'd done a number of sitcoms like The Brady Bunch and so forth. So, again, they had, you know, they were working with heavyweights in the industry. And they shot that in late 65, early 66. Part of the location shoot was down at San Diego, the Civic Center there and at the zoo. And like you said, that concert footage is amazing. You have Hal Blaine with his double bass drum kit with the caricatures of Jan and Dean on the front. Wrecking Crew guys from L.A. came down to join the local musicians there from the local AFM office. And, George Tipton conducting them. And
if you see that, one thing that's really interesting, too, about that film or that pilot is that you really see, like, how kind of reckless Jan is. Like, he's still in, like, his cast, his crutches, and he's basically, you have to see it to believe it, but he's running and tumbling almost the entire film with a cast on.
Yeah.
You know, severe. I mean, he had severely messed up his leg, but he was just, like, totally physical. Like, I just so, like, admire that, even though, in a certain way it's, you know, sad, you know, considering what happened to him. But yeah, I'd really encourage you to check that out on YouTube because it's on there, Jan and Dean on the Run. In late 65, Jan Dean, the surf craze was pretty much dead, and the drag craze, too, and a lot of their people that they were working with, such as Lou Adler and Sloan and Barry, were on the ground floor of the folk rock craze in L.A. that was inspired by the rise of the Byrds. And they did a really interesting album entitled Folk and Roll, on which Jan, in a way, takes alternating perspectives on a lot of the things that were concerns for that crew. And they actually do Barry McGuire's Eve of Destruction, which is written by Sloan and Barry and released on Dunhill. And on the other side, there's a song, a notorious song entitled The Universal Coward, which is a parody of Buffy St. Marie's The Universal Soldier, where Jan takes this really hawkish perspective of saying, you know, protesters are just, you know, cowards, and they're lazy and whatever. And, you know, it's unknown, really, how much Jan really hewed to that, just because, you know, Jan, in his own way, didn't want to go into the surface on his own. But, so, you know, he was just really portraying a role. People shouldn't take that too seriously. And then the project that followed that was another ill-fated project entitled Filet of Soul, which is just... if it had been released at the time, I mean, it really would have predated so much of the stuff Zappa was doing on Freak Out and whatever, in terms of tape collage, sound effects. And, yeah, tell us a little bit about that project so we can play a little bit of it for the folks.
Yeah, so in 65, I think it was September, Jan and Dean headlined the opening of the Hullabaloo Nightclub. Mm-hmm. And they recorded two concerts. I think the concert was in December, but anyway... they recorded it over two nights, and it was a nightclub act, and they, you know, they basically, you know, they had a full Wrecking Crew band behind them, and they told jokes, and it was, you know, it's a posh teenage audience. Mm-hmm. You know, this club had been the Moulin Rouge at one point, and it was opened as a nightclub, and you couldn't wear, you know, pants, or, you know, you had to dress nice, and you could eat. Mm-hmm. The center revolving stage was still there. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know.
That was where the follow-up to the Tammy show, the big TNT show, was filmed, right? When it was still the Moulin Rouge.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
And so the idea was to take the tracks from that, and they did, and they took back in the studio, mm-hmm. and they sweetened the vocals, double-tracked some of the vocals. But what they wanted to do was not... They wanted to amp up the comedy and, you know, the sound effects, mm-hmm. you know, dry, prol jokes, you know, just, mm-hmm. You know, crazy
it's
stuff.
It's basically just like a completely just deconstructionist, avant-garde, comedy, rock, live album that's just unlike anything you've ever heard. What would have been the final version of it, I don't know if a couple different versions have come out. Dean, one of the great things Dean Torrance did when they did a double album anthology in 1971, which was the first really good, and for a long time only really good, compilation of Jan and Dean's work, he took about a 20-minute hunk of their original concept and released it as the fourth side of the record, which is just incredible. My mind was blown. I couldn't figure out what it was.
Right, and he didn't say what it was. Yeah. That's why it was so mind-blowing. And then he later explained it over the years in various interviews. That story started to come out. But when they were trying to put that together, the Liberty guys, the A&R people, it was just beyond them, and they couldn't deal with it.
Well, let's hear a little portion of that, and then we'll follow that with one track. It's the title track. Oh, just the lead single from what ended up being Jan's final artistic effort before his accident. Which is called Jan and Dean Meet Batman, what I call Jan and Dean's Who Sell Out, their own pop art record. And then we'll come and we'll talk some more. So here's a little bit of Filet of Soul, and just prepare yourself for anarchy.
Bad cough you got out there. And then I saw that Jaguar slide into the curve.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw it. I tend to do that. Now what happened?
And then I saw the Jaguar slide into the curve. Yeah. I know I'll never forget that chick who was driving next to me with no hope. But the chick who was driving next to me. I guess I found out for myself that night that you can get an awful sore sternocleidoid mastoid muscle looking at girls like that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And now we come to the fetal portion of our show, in which... The Beatles part of our show... Oh, boy. You mean an analgesic? The Beatles part of our show, where we do a lot of Beatles... Then we finish it up with a lot of Beatles. And then, if that doesn't work, we split. Then we do the cockroaches songs.
And then,
along came Jones. This part of the show is where we sort of relax a little bit. Everybody, just sort of lay back in your chair. We want to do this song again because last show they pressed erase instead of record.
Which is actually better on some of our stuff.
Yes. So Dean would like to do his version of... Like to do his...
I don't know who he is behind that mask, but we need him, and we need him now. He is known as Bruce Wayne by day, well, he's socialite.
It's an omen. I shall become a bat.
And thus is born this weird figure of the dark, this avenger of evil, the Batman.
Batman.
The Shades of Cool, getting into the home stretch of our Jan and Dean. Spectacular, special, super special, with guest Mark A. Moore, who has put together an incredible book entitled The Jan and Dean Record, which chronicles in very, 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 very detailed fashion, but always entertaining and always well-written fashion, Jan and Dean's career, and in particular the artistry of Mr. Jan Barry. We just played some of Jan and Dean's more anarchic material, a couple selections from the original form of Filet of Soul, the comedy version, and those bits were also included on the 1971 United Artists, Legendary Artists, anthology collection. And then we finished it up with the lead single from the Jan and Dean Meet Batman project entitled Batman. And we were just talking about that, in a way, the Batman, Jan and Dean Meet Batman project is being almost an instant album that was that pop culture moment. It was being recorded at the exact same time as the Batman series was premiering in early January 1966. And they came out with just an incredible concept record that is kind of half songs, some instrumentals, and comedy skits that are just absolutely paralyzing, particularly if you have any knowledge, inner knowledge of Jan and Dean and their friends and all that type of stuff. It's really a hilarious record. And I always think it was being similar to The Who's Sell Out, because that record's filled with commercials and very spoken bits and whatever. And it's great. Well, getting close to the end now, so we can get through some things. On April 12th, a very awful thing happened to Jan Barry, and let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, he had been, as a result of that leg injury, he ran into problems at medical school. He couldn't keep up just physically.
Which, of course, we actually haven't even talked about that, so we should, during this entire period, this is one of the most unique things about Jan and Dean's career, is that while they were at the height of their career, they were both studying, they were both in school. Jan was studying to be a surgeon, and Dean was studying architecture. So during the entire time, they would just be touring on weekends, and in the summer they would tour, but they were committed, school the whole time, which is just so unique. There's nothing, no one else I can think of, really, that's true of.
Certainly for their era, too. Yeah. But with falling behind physically, unable to keep up, he had to withdraw in good standing from medical school, and he set it up to get back to re-enter for his sophomore year in September of 66. But having, that lapse in school, even though it was, in good standing and he was green-lighted to get back in, well, the Vietnam War was ramping up in mid-60s, and so the draft was an issue, and he had to go for a physical, and they were breathing down his neck about it, and it was a problem. He's certainly very angry about it, and he went to his draft board meeting, and they had been on the road a lot on and off in March, and they would fly out to any part of the country, come back to L.A., drive out again, fly out again, whatever, so just really hectic.
And it really was, the whole thing with the draft board was definitely just a strange annoyance that really was just down to just bureaucratic strangeness. Just because, I mean, there were people like Frank Sinatra had a perforated eardrum from birth and was immediately 4F.
Right.
Jan's leg was completely, there was no way
he would have passed his physical.
But he had to keep going time after time after time to get it sorted out.
And so that morning, it was an early morning, it was 9:40, I think, the appointment. And so he had to go get that straightened out. And the result of that meeting was he was not drafted, but he was still eligible. Still eligible for military services. Incredibly angry about it, and the accident occurred on a residential street in Beverly Hills, Whittier Drive, between Sunset Boulevard and Wilshire Boulevard. It's a residential area. The speed limit was 25 miles an hour, but he was flying through there.
As was Jan's custom.
As was his custom. All the reckless driving is all true. You just ask Bones Howe, ask Dean, anybody, and that he really was hell for leather behind the wheel, and so. He hit a curb and
he just clipped with his
right wheel tire came off. He lost control and hit a parked gardener's truck. The gardener was standing right there, a guy named Mitsuru Ando. Great account from him in the book. He witnessed the whole thing at close range.
Very compelling. This whole section having to do with the accident is really incredible in the book.
So, that's one of the most mythic things. A lot of misinformation about that accident over the years. And the book tries to clear some of that up. or a lot of that up. But yeah, so long story short, that's the end of everything in terms of Jan and Dean's original career. And so he's brain damaged, partially paralyzed on the right side, hemiparesis. And he's got aphasia, apraxia. He has to learn to communicate again. And, you know, that's really the driving force behind the 1978 film is coming back from that. And, but 1 year to the month after the accident, he's back in the studio.
And, shortly after that, with the back on the road driving, I couldn't believe that. I had no idea.
Crazy.
Like, when I read that book. Like, and I thought I knew a lot. It's like, he was driving again.
So he's in the studio in April of 67, but he's also driving in April of 67. Yeah. He's also getting an accident.
Yeah.
He hit a parked car again. he had fender benders left and right. It was unreal.
Oh, my God. But, it's just incredible. But in the short term, what Dean Torrance tried to do is, because he wasn't really aware for a while, like, of how serious it was, he tried to keep Jan and Dean's career going by doing his own studio projects with legendary bass player Joe Osborne and Joe Osborne's home garage studio, which in a way took Jan and Dean's career back to its garage origins in a way.
Right.
And came up with a really interesting concept album entitled Save for a Rainy Day. All the songs are based around the concept of rain. And, has the sounds of rain and storms that are happening between every track. And, you know, you could definitely say that's ahead of its time as well. And, Jan's parents, which were his conservatives and guardians at the time, you know, after his accident, and Jan himself weren't too happy about it. And Jan, was continually foiled in his efforts to release the record, both on the label he started entitled J&D, and then somehow got them signed to Columbia and to release it, and they were partially remixed the record and changed things, but he wasn't able to. That contract fell through, so Dean kind of in bitterness withdrew from the whole scene after that happened.
The company that had been driving Jan and Dean's career all along, Screen Gems, they were the mother company. They oversaw Jan's contracts as a songwriter, a record producer, and an artist. And so after the accident, those contracts remained active. Mm-hmm. And so Dean not realizing that, he ran afoul of them from a legal standpoint. Mm-hmm. He didn't have the legal authority to release Jan and Dean material or use the name.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got these great projects together. He's definitely on the right track creatively, getting stuff, getting the great musicians, you know, all that. Mm-hmm. It just fell into place. But with the Screen Gems thing, it just really, they shut down all those projects, and they never came out until much later.
Yeah, and it was finally officially released sometime in the 90s on Sundays. And if you haven't heard Save for a Rainy Day, it's one of the great underground pop records. It has a very strange, eerie, distant quality to it that's partially technical, because it was kind of garage tapes that were overdubbed over too many times, and a bunch of the sound was lost, but it has a very, very beautiful, you know, odd quality to it. It's very autumnal, and it's kind of like about, you know, the loss of that time period in Los Angeles. Is a really great thing to listen to. By 1968, 1967, Jan was already, he was already back in the studio working on what turned out to be a project that was also ill-fated, entitled Carnival of Sound, and Jan and Dean got signed to Warner Brothers Records. And I think people, you know, at that time just didn't realize just how damaged Jan was.
Right.
They thought, oh, he's back in the studio. Oh, it'll be, you know, but Jan had a lot of problems. You know, a lot of his filters and his able to, like, what to say and what not to say. And he was pretty impulsive.
Yes.
So, a couple singles were released, but nothing much happened. But the material ended up filtering out over about 40 years of, you know, collectors, you know, things and all that. But eventually Rhino got a hold of the tapes, right? And you had something to do with this.
Yeah, well, the good thing about that was, it's a shame it took so long, because, you know, Reiner is a Warner Brothers company, and they're Warner Brothers masters. So they're basically sitting on their own masters all that time.
Yeah.
Because the Liberty overseeing tracks that Jan had done, Hawaii, Fantan, Love and Hate in 67, Warner Brothers bought those masters to count against the first tracks for the Warner Brothers contract. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, they were basically sitting on their own masters all those years.
Yep. And Jan was, he didn't sing much on these ones. Like, it's funny, because the Save for a Rainy Day is Dean without Jan at all. and Carnival of Sound is Jan without Dean and with a mixture of studio vocalists and a little bit of his own vocals.
Yeah, a little smattering here and there, but it's mostly famous studio singers, Ron Hickman and his guys, Bob Swern, B.J. Baker,
The Ballers,
Ian Free, Baron Smith.
Yeah.
Really, really amazing studio singers. And Glenn Campbell, of course.
Oh, yeah. And Jan was able to take his music in a totally different direction in terms of, you know, late 60s orchestrated L.A. pop psychedelia. He was utilizing sitar to a mind-blowing extent. But it really is a Carnival of Sound. Let's juxtapose. We'll play one track from Dean's Save for a Rainy Day and one track from Jan's Carnival of Sound. We'll play one more Carnival of Sound to close. But here's Like a Summer Rain from Save for a Rainy Day and Girl, You're Blowing My Mind from Carnival of Sound. Welcome back to Shades of Cool. Just about to wrap up our excellent Jan and Dean special feature with our good friend Mark A. Moore in the studio to promote his great book, The Jan and Dean Record, A Chronology of Studio Sessions, Live Performances, and Chart Positions. It's a nearly 500-page book. It's a real labor of love. It's been about 16 years, right? 17 years in the offing. It's McFarlane Press put it out, and it's a really, really beautiful book. If you have any interest in, if you like anything that you've heard, if you have any interest in 60s, Los Angeles rock and roll, surf music, drag, pop music, anything, you're just going to want to get this book. It's just absolutely gorgeous. And I want to thank you, Mark, for coming in and talking about this book with us. And for Jan, he lived almost another 40 years after his accident, right?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, and was able to make some more. Of course, Jan and Dean reunited after their the TV movie based on their life came out, based on their early career anyway, up to Jan's accident and their first attempts at reuniting. And it was a rough road for Jan, you know. He went through a lot of hard times, and his relationship with Dean has been off, and it was off and on and all that. But
right.
But overall, I think Jan did pretty well.
I think so.
You know, the situation that he was in. And I think, in a way, the Carnival of Sound release was like really like a capper for that.
Right.
You know, for people really, you know, realizing, you know, what a great guy he was and what a real artist. But we're going to play, actually, I should say that Girl, You're Blowing My Mind, which we just heard, lead vocal on that is by Mr. Glenn Campbell. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know. But we're going to hear our last song tonight is going to be the title track from Carnival of Sound. So what should we say about that? It's pretty great.
Yeah, that's, you know.
It's just a pretty cool track. I mean, this really, it's a perfect title track for the record because it, when you hear it, it really is a Carnival of Sound. It's just a swirling melange of pop and psych and just everything else that was going on at the time. It's very Los Angeles, you know.
And Tom Baylor on lead vocals.
Yeah. And it's just a, you know, shame that it didn't come out at the time. Was this one going to be released as a single or a flip side for a single?
For Carnival of Sound?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think it's just the title track.
Yeah. But Carnival of Sound, it did come out on Rhino Handmade. And there should be copies of it still around. And you should definitely pick it up. It's really great. As well as pick up the Jan and Dean record, which is a book by Mark A. Moore, who's our guest. And you can get that on Amazon and any other online retailer in McFarlane's own website. So thank you for joining us, Mark.
Thanks so much.
I appreciate it.
And great.
And we'll do it again sometime soon.
Absolutely.
We'll talk more album tracks, more humor, play more of Filet of Soul.
Yeah.
Maybe play the whole thing for fun. And we'll see you next week. We're going to be doing a Kink special next week. But here's Carnival of Sound. See you next week.
Life can have a higher meaning in a carnival of sound. Release the thoughts inside your mind. See if the truth is there to find. Search yourself and analyze. Thoughts just can't be compromised. Thoughts of anger,
Thoughts of anger in the carnival of